This podcast exists because of our paid supporters at DecodingTV.com. Head over to DecodingTV.com to sign up and receive ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus episodes that Kim Renfro and I will record just for members. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
Where is the Queen? I had hoped to pay my respects.
I understand the Queen is still readying herself for the celebrations.
This is why men wage war. Because a woman would never be ready for the battle in time.
Your presence is always such a pleasure, Lord Jason.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial recap podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I'm David Chen, and I have not read Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon is based.
And I'm Kim Renfro, and I have read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based.
Welcome to the show, everyone. This week on this podcast, as we do every week, we're going to be recapping and discussing House of the Dragon, Season 1, Episode 5, We Light the Way. We will not be spoiling anything from future week's episodes. That includes anything on the next time on preview. That includes anything that's in the books. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Find us on YouTube at youtube.com/acastofkings. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Before we get to this week's episode, a couple of announcements, a couple quick follow-ups. First of all, we were mentioned in a small local New York Metro paper called the New York Times this past week. Hooray! Thank you so much to the New York Times for mentioning us as one of mentioning us as a great podcast to enhance your TV binge watching. So A Cast of Kings was mentioned, the great work of Joanna Robinson on this podcast was mentioned, and also Kim Renfro and myself were mentioned in the article. So we're really grateful for the New York Times for paying attention to us. Also, I think the only one in the Game of Thrones category to be mentioned, if I recall correctly. So
it's a huge testament to your work and Joanna's.
Well, we're so grateful to the New York Times for mentioning us. We're also, I'm personally grateful to both Joanna for all the work that she did over the course of the last decade, but also you, Kim Renfro, for agreeing to assume the mantle of Game of Thrones expert on this podcast. Literally, the show would not be possible. The podcast would not be possible without you. So appreciative of all of that. And if you're just tuning in, thank you so much for giving us a shot. And we hope you enjoy this episode of the podcast. Before we get to this week's episode of House of the Dragon, I wanted to follow up with something from last week. You can always write into us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Ronnie writes in, and please let us know where you're writing in from. Quote, one of the aspects I've not heard discussed about the sex scenes from episode 4 is they all touch on very gray areas of sexual abuse in society. The first scene with Alicent and Viserys, it's quite obvious this was not consensual from both parties. But that Alicent felt she had to because they're married. Is it sexual abuse if you're married? The second scene with Daemon and Rhaenyra. Daemon obviously is an older, influential person in her life. He uses that alcohol and environment to sexually abuse her. And then when he realizes that she's actually into it, abandons her. And lastly, with Rhaenyra and Kristen, she uses her authority and takes advantage of that situation and puts Kristen in a position where he really cannot turn her down. He's already told her that she gave him and his family the highest honor they've ever had. For him to say no and leave would surely mean he would lose that position. I found it very interesting they were able to present all these forms of sexual abuse from different perspectives so effectively, end quote. Agreed with the sentiment, Ronnie. But also, I felt like we did try to talk about some of those things, which leads me to a big question. Are people who write the emails in actually listening to the podcast? No, I'm just joking. I mean, you'd be surprised. I have hosted podcasts and people will say, oh yeah, I'm a big fan of that podcast. And it'll be obvious that they've actually listened to it. And then I'll say, oh, that's cool. I hosted literally every one of the 100 plus episodes of that podcast. And they'll say, oh, really? You know, as though they, you know, but anyway, I don't think Ronnie's quite that extreme, but we did try to touch upon some of these dynamics. I think probably the one that we could have talked a little bit more about maybe is the Sir Criston Cole one, the dynamic there, right? Which is that we did remark that it felt consensual what happened between Kristen and Rhaenyra at the same time. There is an undeniable power dynamic there. Right, Kim? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the way that I kind of landed on it was that it felt consensual after his cloak was off and like most mm-hmm. of his armor was removed. And of course that's extremely symbolic that like the part that it felt like Rhaenyra was definitely crossing a line and using her power was like in getting him into the room and starting to remove, like he was so stiff and like unresponsive when she was first kind of like going after his armor. And it's true that she really put him in a lose-lose situation because either he turns down the princess who he's sworn to obey and protect and like ruins that relationship, or he has sex with her outside of marriage, outside of his vows as a Kingsguard. It totally makes sense why that was an extremely pivotal point in Sir Criston's relationship to this royal family and all the feelings. Because yeah, it absolutely was not a clean, sweet, romantic moment. There were absolutely mm-hmm. power dynamics at play that were making it deeply uncomfortable. So yeah.
But yeah, I really agree with Ronnie's email. Like each one of those sexual encounters from episode 4 had something unsettling about it in some way. Totally. And I thought the show illustrated it beautifully overall. So I don't think that Kim and I thought that all the encounters were okay on any level.
No.
That one was probably the most quote unquote okay, but even that one, the one between Rhaenyra and Criston, was probably like the least upsetting one. But it was still plenty upsetting, I would say. So
yeah.
Okay. Well, you can always write into us at acastofkings@gmail.com or comment at decodingtv.com. And we do record bonus episodes for Decoding TV members where we address a lot of emails as well as comments. And we'll try to get one of those out this week as well. Kim Renfro, let's get to season 1, episode 5 of House of the Dragon. We Light the Way. This is another episode directed by Claire Kilner. I think she did last episode as well, right?
Yep.
Let's talk about overall thoughts on this episode. What did you think of We Light the Way?
I thought it was great. Once again, I think that the show just really keeps building on itself in a super meaningful way. And I think that this was kind of like the big climax of all of these characters in this like younger sort of like we're seeing all the chances that things could have gone right. And then they're just going horribly, horribly wrong. And this was sort of the culmination of all of that. I loved that feast scene, really good, like tension ramping up with the music and the like seeing all of these people that we've been getting to know over the last 4 episodes, all be in the same room and where all of the tensions erupt was really cool.
Yeah, I like the episode as well. I think there were some elements of the episode that were a little bit confusing/ambiguous, as evidenced by a lot of the response to it. I think there was like differing interpretations of how things played out. The biggest one being why Sir Criston does what he does at the end of the episode. And I've heard like multiple interpretations, theories of that. We'll talk about that. So, and it was done in a way that I didn't feel it was like intentionally ambiguous, but maybe it was. Anyway, I'll also say that I love that final sequence as well. It's just really well done. It's rare for an episode of Game of Thrones to have an extended sequence in one location. It happens, but you know, Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, like, but having one long sequence and the music in the sequence, very percussive, like the editing, the tension building, the ramp up, and then finally the release, it was all very well done, I thought. So I enjoyed this episode as well. Not as strong as episode 4, in my opinion, but I really, really liked it. And there's just a lot to dig into. So let's get into it. The episode opens at Runestone, a castle on the peninsula by the Vale where House Arryn rules. We finally meet Lady Rhea Royce, Daemon's wife in name only.
Yeah,
they're married, but he has not consummated the marriage. He's obviously not a huge fan of her. And I'm actually kind of, it raises the question of why he's not a huge fan of her. She seems lovely and completely badass, but maybe that's why, is because he feels threatened by her badassery. I don't know.
He can't control her, right? Mm-hmm. Like she's so dismissive of him. And obviously he hates that. He wants suppliance at all times, not an equal.
So he is not a fan of, they're clearly not fans of each other. That's very clear. And, you know, the whole time I'm thinking to myself, man, finally we meet Rhea Royce, a character I've been wanting to meet for 4 weeks. Surely this is the beginning of a long and fruitful Rhea Royce plotline on the show. But She's basically the crab feeder of Daemon's wives. You know, we barely knew ye. We barely knew ye, Rhea Royce.
It's true.
Daemon's like, hey, he straight up murders her, is what is implied, right? He causes her horse to flip up and then fall down on her and seemingly paralyzing her. And then we see him pick up a rock. Awesome transition into a fish's head getting cut off.
Yeah.
We don't actually see him murder her, but it is described later that she is killed. And so we have to assume that it was him that did it.
Yeah, this was like a bold way to open the episode, because in the books, her death is pretty much just marked down as an act, like a hunting accident, the way that it's sort of described by others in this episode. But obviously, anytime that a woman who's in an inconvenient marriage suddenly dies at a young age, I think that some suspicion should be cast upon it. And so I love that the House of Dragon writers made the choice to just like clearly show that, yes, Daemon was the culprit here. She didn't just like accidentally fall off her horse. She was murdered, especially as a setup to the rest of the episode. Like seeing something that violent out the gate and very kind of unpredictable in terms of like an adaptation choice, I thought was really cool.
The question I have is, why aren't people murdering their spouses all the time in this world? Because apparently you can get away with it and also inherit everything, you know, which is what Daemon is positioning himself to do. And I assume a lot of these spouses don't like each other. So I wish maybe they're like, ideally there would have been a little more planning that went into it. Daemon's like, okay, she's going to be alone at this. He's doing like a heist with like scale model. And he's like, okay, she's going to be alone at this moment. And that would have showed that he like put some effort into it. It almost feels like a split second decision almost like in the moment. I don't think it was like, but he just shows up and she's like, wait a second, you're going to kill me. And you know, like that's not, if that was his objective, he wouldn't even let himself be seen. He would just, you know.
Yeah.
He would do it in a different way of like, I don't know. Anyway, maybe like not. Maybe that was the perfect way to off Leah, Lady Royce, but I don't know.
I think like the threat and like knocking her off the horse was very intentional. I wasn't sure if he actually was going to follow through with crushing her head with a rock until she taunts him like from the ground, right? And says like, I knew you couldn't finish. And there's like Matt Smith kind of pauses and I'm like, yeah. Oh, is that him like making some sort of split decision to murder her with a rock in that way? But like he wouldn't have known that she would be paralyzed from the fall from her horse. So a little murky there, but certainly showing that Daemon is like reckless, violent, and not afraid to commit murder pretty blatantly because he's so sure that he's going to get away with it. And in the episode he does, like when her cousin tries to accuse him at dinner, I think he thinks it's going to be this big like showdown, and Daemon just completely brushes it aside and nobody else really seems to care.
Well, the best part of that scene is Daemon responds to him by saying, are you here to make a confession of some kind? It's like, wow, that's such a bold thing to say if you're the actual perpetrator.
Yeah.
But yeah, all fair points about Daemon's character that were made by the scene. So we cut to Viserys. He is throwing up over the edge of the ship. I love this guy offers him like, hey, do you want the airplane bag, you know, but it's like it looked almost like a chamber pot to me. But anyway, he's like, no, I prefer to just raw dog my vomiting right over the edge.
That's much more dignified.
He's clearly not in a good state. We learn that he is heading to Lord Corlys's castle to ask for the Laenor marriage, you know that Rhaenyra and Laenor be joined in marriage. And there is a brief interlude where we go back to King's Landing and Alicent and Otto have a goodbye, because Otto, as you remember from last episode, has been ejected from the small council. But I didn't realize this meant he had to like leave town as well. That wasn't 100% clear to me. I guess he's kind of like been exiled, or is he leaving town? Like,
I think he is. I don't know that he has to, but it certainly seems
maybe just
him.
He has to leave the castle. He has to leave the Red Keep, right? And he's going to be somewhere in King's Landing. So, but he and Alicent used to see each other all the time. Now they can't hang out anymore, probably. And so it's kind of sad. And he gives a really powerful speech where he says, "Look, Aegon is either going to be the heir, and you need to prepare for that, or Rhaenyra is going to be the heir, and she's going to want to kill Aegon to prevent him from ascending to the throne. Like one or the other, you seem to not be doing either of these things very well."
Mm-hmm.
And it feels to me to be pretty sensible advice. What do you think of Otto Hightower, who I know you've said in the past is the worst?
He is. He's up there. I mean, no man in this show is safe from my opinion at this point. Mm-hmm. They're all doing mm-hmm. a pretty good job of vying for being the most messed up. I don't mm-hmm. know. I think that Otto, it's almost like he's doing a self-fulfilling prophecy thing, right? Where by deciding that those are the only two outcomes, he's pretty much ensuring that one of them happens. Like, I don't think that it's a total foregone conclusion that Rhaenyra would absolutely put children to the sword when she ascends the Iron Throne. We don't really have any evidence so far that she's hateful or threatening towards her half siblings. She just kind of doesn't interact with them at all. But so I don't know. I think that he's making a compelling point. I think that it's a little bit refreshing for him to finally be so directly speaking to Alicent about what might happen in her future and the danger that she and her children might be in. But it's also like many of the things that Otto and Viserys do, it's too little too late. It's why are you telling her this now? Why weren't you being really forthcoming with her before about your feelings about the realm and how things might shift? And
yeah, you could have let her know about your plans yesterday, Otto Hightower, you know,
right?
Potentially.
Actually talk to her instead, because Alicent was in the room when Otto came to Viserys with his news that there had been this Daemon Rhaenyra sighting, and nobody spoke to her. Viserys ignored her after that. Otto just walked right out of the room. So it's they keep not including Rhaenyra and Alicent in these significant conversations. And then when everything goes to crap, they're see, that's what we knew would happen. And it's I don't think that that's necessarily correct. And I just feel I really feel for Alicent in this scene, because she already told us last episode that she's extremely lonely and doesn't seem to have any friends at court. She's increasingly more uncomfortable around Viserys, I think. When we see her holding her baby crying in one shot of this scene, she's not even looking at her child. She might even have some sort of postpartum depression happening. But I don't know, for Otto to embrace her and try and have this tearful goodbye, and I was just this isn't helping her at all. He's really just one more person who's leaving her completely alone to try and figure out what the best thing to do is. And then enter a mysterious figure who suddenly has answers for her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, before we get to that, I do want to say, are you familiar with the prisoner's dilemma, the game theory idea?
Yeah.
For those who don't know, the prisoner's dilemma is this fictional idea where if two people are caught, right, here's the dilemma as presented in the William Poundstone book, Prisoner's Dilemma. Two members of a criminal gang are arrested and imprisoned. Each prisoner is in solitary confinement with no means of speaking to or exchanging messages with the other. The police admit they don't have enough evidence to convict the pair on the principal charge. They plan to sentence both to a year in prison on a lesser charge. But they also offer each prisoner a bargain. They basically say, if you betray each other, each of you serves 2 years in prison. If one of you betrays the other and the other one doesn't, you know, the person who does the betraying will be set free and the other person will get 3 years in prison. If you both remain silent, both of you will serve 1 year in prison. So basically, if everyone stays silent, everyone gets the least punishment. If both of you turn on each other, you both get a medium punishment. And if one of you betrays the other and the other one doesn't betray you, then, you know, the person doing the betraying goes free and the other person gets a harsh punishment.
Yeah.
And the theory states that basically in that scenario, the best strategy for all people is to betray the other person.
Mm-hmm.
you will basically arrive at the best outcome most of the time if you betray the other person. And it's like a game theory, you know, human psychology thought experiment that states that in a scenario where, you know, it requires trusting the other person will do the right thing, you're better off statistically if you don't do the right thing. And that's kind of what I felt when Otto was talking to her about this, is like, okay, yeah, you could trust Rhaenyra to not murder Aegon, but I wouldn't take that bet. And it is sad that a lot of what we get in human society is a result of what, in my opinion, is like prisoner's dilemma style thinking, where you assume the worst outcome.
Yeah. I remember being in an econ class in college and the professor like positing that to us before telling us what the result of the statistics were. And I was like, obviously, you're not going to rat out the other person. Like, stay quiet. But then, yeah, there's like a, I remember seeing like a square and it's
like a grid.
Right. And three out of the four results is someone betraying the other. So if you go for staying silent, you're picking like the 25% chance that the other person also stays silent.
Exactly.
But also, I would like to know if they did those experiments with men only, as is often the case in like these old data behavioral statistic things, you know, like wasn't there also some horrifying like prison experiment thing
that
was like determined like, oh, people will like debase themselves into like terrible things if left alone. And it was like, well, those were all white dudes. so maybe
to
maybe
be fair,
that said more.
My understanding is that the results of the Stanford prison experiment have been disproven in the time since then, is my understanding. But
good.
I'm not caught up with the latest in the literature. Anyway, those are some thoughts on the prisoner's dilemma as they apply to the world of Westeros. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more thoughts on this encounter that Alicent has in the Godswood. It's time to thank our sponsor, HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. Now, I don't know about you folks, but my schedule is packed. I am doing so many podcasts these days. And if you also have a packed schedule, HelloFresh has meals covered with a weekly selection of 30 plus recipes and 70 plus convenience items all delivered to your door. HelloFresh is here to make your hectic fall weeknights a little bit easier and a lot more delicious. They have quick and easy meals, which include 20 minute meals, low prep, easy cleanup. Take the stress out of mealtime with time-saving, no-fuss recipes in a snap. HelloFresh works with your schedule. Plans are flexible. You can change your meal preferences, update your delivery day, and even change your address with just a few taps on the HelloFresh app. What I love about HelloFresh is it teaches you how to make food. It teaches you how to cook. You start by making things like chicken and mushroom risotto, or barbecue cheddar burgers, And eventually, once you make enough of their delicious dishes, you start feel like you have a general proficiency with cooking that you didn't have before. But HelloFresh also makes it super easy to make delicious, healthy home-cooked meals. And I'm just so grateful for how they've improved my life, my workflow, my week. They make it go a lot smoother, a lot easier, and make me feel a lot better about what I'm eating. If all that sounds good to you, boy, we have a deal for you. If you are a Cast of Kings listener, all you got to do is go to HelloFresh.com/Kings65. That's Kings and then the numerals 6 and 5. And use code KINGS65 for 65% off plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/KINGS65. And use code KINGS65 for 65% off plus free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. All right. So as you were just saying, Kim Renfro, she has an encounter with who? This dude that was sitting with the other ladies in at the hunt a couple episodes ago, right?
Yeah, so this is Laerys Strong. He's one of the sons of Sir Lionel Strong, who, as we see in this episode, has been named the new Hand of the King in place of Otto. Laerys is brothers with Harwin Strong, aka Breakbones, who is the brother who kind of like muscles his way through the crowd at the end of this episode to help Rhaenyra, and we've seen him a few other times. So yeah, Laerys, he has a clubfoot. He has to walk with a cane, and that sort of like makes it so that he doesn't participate in the regular male-oriented practices of the realm. Like he can't go on the hunt, so he sits in the tent in on like the gossip circle and basically gets all of the best information. And in this episode, he's clearly making some moves where he seeks out Alicent in front of the weirwood tree, and basically like in a roundabout way, lets her know that Moon Tea was sent to Rhaenyra in the dead of night, which is very suspicious to anybody hearing that on the outside. Obviously, Alicent at this point believes Rhaenyra that she didn't have any sort of sexual relations with anybody outside of her marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And Laerys just kind of puts a sharp point on that.
Yes. Well, Laerys seems to crave drama, is one of my senses from the episode, you know, and he's definitely getting it. And just the way that he speaks, you love the subtext, you know. Oh yes, I'm so concerned about the lady. It's like, no you're not, you just want to stir some stuff up. But I love the performance. It's so kind of loaded with subtext,
and like smirks and like glances to see if she's registering, you know, if she's picking up what he's laying down,
what he's larissing down. And we'll see what his kind of end game is, if any. You know, perhaps there are other broader storytelling purposes for this character. But in the meantime, he is stirring things up and seemingly really enjoying it. Also, the first thing I thought when I saw this scene came was, wow, this really blows a hole in our theory that our possible theory that Alicent might have been behind the Moon Tea last week, huh?
Oh, true. True. No, anything, I wrote in all caps in my notes. I was like, did Laerys send the Moon Tea? Because like... How does he know?
Well, it's true because we see the Moon Tea being brought to her, but we don't see like Laerys in the background like looking at anything. So it is a little odd that he would know about it, but yeah.
And the fact that we don't see Viserys, like the fact that we only have it from the Maester that this was like the king's orders, but we didn't actually see that happen. So it's like, did someone else tell the Maester? And this is, I might have talked about this last episode. Forgive me if I already did, but like, it's very common throughout all stages of Westerosi history and the stories that George R. R. Martin has written. Moon Tea being like delivered to a room can often be used as the basis of rumor, even if that person didn't even drink the Moon Tea, they didn't request it. But just the fact that Moon Tea can be sent around, it's often weaponized to try and like paint a woman as, I don't know, some sort of like harlot or something. I'm pretty sure there's a whole subplot in A Song of Ice and Fire where Cersei seems aware that Margaery Tyrell has Moon Tea being brewed regularly, like for her handmaidens. But then Cersei's like, why would a like sanctimonious young woman need Moon Tea so frequently? So like, I keep kind of thinking about this because I'm like, if it wasn't Viserys, which I'm not sure that it was, someone doing that was probably doing it to try and like have more evidence to sully Rhaenyra's reputation around at least King's Landing, if not the whole realm.
Or perhaps Laerys has powers beyond what we know about in the show and his ability to see things, perhaps. I'm just throwing that out there as a...
Are you trying to get me on the Green Seer theory?
No, I would never. I would never.
I will say about Laerys is that it seems suspicious that we're seeing a weirwood tree so frequently in connection to him. And there are also rats everywhere in like very intimate scenes. We saw a rat in the bed where Alicent and Viserys were. There's a rat eating blood in this episode. There's rats everywhere. So
all right,
we'll get to that later.
We may talk about it.
I know you have thoughts.
Yes, we will. Okay. So Alicent is really upset and she's going to learn how upset she is later in the episode. But then we go to Viserys and Rhaenyra. They're at Driftmark, which is Lord Corlys's castle. The whole thing is very disrespectful to King Viserys because Lord Corlys isn't there to greet them. The fact that King Viserys needs to show up there at all is kind of a slight, right? Because my understanding from these times when there were royals and kings and such is like, and to some degree is still true today, is that who goes to which location reveals what the power differential is.
Sure.
And basically, if you're the king, people come to you. That's just the whole thing. If you're the king, you're the most powerful, people need to come to you. You generally don't go somewhere else because you going somewhere else like raises that person up generally, or they are you're acknowledging that they're in some way more powerful than you, or they have more clout than you because they can refuse your invitation. Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking because the pilot of Game of Thrones is King Robert arriving to Winterfell. Like, that's a long journey. Yeah. Getting to Driftmark from King's Landing is like a half a day's boat ride, I'm going to guess. But like, King Robert spent months going to Winterfell. And in that case, it was viewed as like an honor because he was there to raise Ned Stark's status to Hand of the King. And like, there was a lot of ceremony. The castle had everybody prepared. There were like dozens of people in the courtyard waiting to greet the king. And so you're totally right that like, it is a very clear sign that the power dynamic is not like respectful. I'm coming here to like raise your station and name your son heir. There's a lot more tension around it because Corlys does not roll out the red carpet for Viserys arriving, which immediately like puts him, you know, on his back foot a little bit.
Yeah. And it's really sad, the scene that greets them when they, you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Lord Corlys' children or anything, but it's just like, there's just nothing there. There's no pomp or circumstance. He just kind of arrives. And it seems like a massive pain in the ass to get up to that castle too. Like, it's at the top of this huge hill and it's beautiful. Like, the road that leads up to it is beautiful. And it's kind of like, there's like a massive moat. It's kind of like an archipelago of sorts.
I feel like there's a castle in like France or something like this, right? Where like the road, the access road would literally disappear with high tide. So like, clearly Driftmark is a place where if you're not very seafaring, which as we see,
Viserys is nicely done.
Viserys is not. Yeah, that's... that's all the ocean puns I have in me for the day.
All maybe. Right.
We'll see. As we
keep... Okay, you're out of control, Kim. You're out of control. So Viserys enters the main hall at Driftmark, and there's a bunch of interactions that I thought were really interesting in this scene. One of the things that happens is his cousin comes in, right? And kind of greets him by grasping his hands, and she realizes something's wrong because he's missing fingers. And she's like, are you doing okay? And he clearly is like not well. Like, he's, you know, ill. He's feeling not good from the seasickness. He's missing fingers. Like, she starts like getting pretty concerned about him.
Yeah, because they haven't seen him in, I think it's supposed to be about 3 years, since before the Stepstones War happened. This is the first time they're seeing each other in person since Viserys announced that Alicent would be his wife instead of Lena. So I love that, like, Rhaenys kind of like comes in all warm and like, cousin, oh, it's so, like, kind of like diffuses the tension that was just set up by like the lack of greeting, kind of like compensating for it. I feel like both Rhaenys and Corlys like play Viserys like a fiddle in this entire scene. Like, they have the whole dynamic set up to try and like put him at ease, but then also put him back on his toes a little bit with like their questions about exactly what's going on. And yeah, obviously his diminished health is extremely obvious in this moment.
He wants to ask for a marriage between Laenor and Rhaenyra, King Viserys does. And Lord Corlys is open to it with some stipulations. He says, quote, we would like to know how the succession will be handled, because basically Lord Corlys would like any children that Laenor and Rhaenyra produce to be Velaryon children, which King Viserys is not super cool with, because he's saying the line of Targaryens would end with this child. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So he arrives at a pretty smart compromise, in my opinion. What did you think? So what is the compromise, Kim, and what did you think of it?
So the compromise is that their children will have the last name Valerian, but whenever that oldest child ascends to the Iron Throne, they will take up that mantle under the name Targaryen. So it's almost like getting a name change, not because of marriage, but because of a promotion, which is kind of cool.
Right. I've been watching The Crown season one this week, and there's just a lot of House of the Dragon, The Crown parallels, in my opinion. One of the big pieces of contention in The Crown was, what would Queen Elizabeth's husband's and their children's last name be?
Right.
And her children are all Windsor, right? Like, because that's her name. And it was a point of great contention for him. You know, he had to really give that up, because that's typically how it's done, is like the male last name is used. But yeah, it's the source of a lot of thought and contention, is my sense.
You know what messes me up sometimes? Thinking about how even if, because I didn't change my last name. I'm married. I didn't change my last name and I don't plan on changing it. But like even me keeping my last name, it's still my dad's name. Mm-hmm. Like my last name is not my mother's maiden mm-hmm. name. And even mm-hmm. my mother's maiden name was her dad's last name. It's like, mm-hmm. it's kind of inescapable.
It's dad's name all the way down. It's dad's just, name's all the way down.
Yeah. So like you keep what you can, but I really thought that this was a great conversation about like the logistics and very smart of Corliss to A, ensure like we're only doing this marriage because my son is going to be king. I think that he's like, when he says, I want to ensure the line of succession, it's not just about Rhaenyra and Laenor's future children. It's about Rhaenyra herself. Like he wants to hear one more time, you're definitely not going to make Aegon your heir, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Until this point in the show, and you may not know the answer to this, Kim. Sorry, I don't like to like throw you a question that you don't haven't prepped for. Oh, but
keep me on my toes.
Until this point in the show, has there been a queen ruler with a husband in the show? Because in Game of Thrones, right, like Cersei was queen, but she didn't have a husband.
And right, so she was queen regent. In gotcha. Tommen and Joffrey's stead, kind of like waiting for them to come of age.
Mm-hmm,
I think
mm-hmm.
that can happen sometimes.
Got it.
But no, it's never been like you are queen for the rest of your life.
Yeah. That's never happened in the world of Westeros. Basically.
Not in Westeros yet. Yeah. No.
So the idea of like Rhaenyra being queen would be like unprecedented, but so would having like a first dude, basically like a first. Right. You know,
it's like if we ever get a female president in the country having to refer to her husband as the first gentleman.
Gentleman, yes.
Because
yes.
they call Kamala Harris's husband second gentleman.
Gentleman? Got it. Right? Yeah, there you go.
But
there
like, yeah, that was a
or,
thing.
Or
that,
dude, as I put forward. You know,
second that, dude. That would also, yeah, that first would also dude work. And second dude yeah. of the house. Sounds great to me. Yeah, no, it's but something yeah, that you
and
have
it,
to
it would make
out.
Sense that he would want to like negotiate what that looks like.
Yeah, before agreeing to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Smart. I think that Corliss and Rhaenys kind of come out on top in this episode for sure.
Yeah. There's a set of sequences where we see some nice interactions, one between Rhaenyra and Laenor. We also see like what Corliss and his wife actually think of this whole situation. They, you know, Rhaenys is basically like, it's below their dignity to have come here. Mm-hmm. And she's probably right about that. And you realize like how manipulative, like it kind of casts that earlier scene in a new light where you've realized like how completely manipulative they were being, but they clearly are in it together. You love to see it. You love to see a nice power couple doing mm-hmm. what they can to get the most out of things. And mm-hmm. then there's a scene between Laenor and his lover, Lord Joffrey, I believe is his name, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't know if he's a lord.
Okay, fair enough. Joffrey.
Just dude. Joffrey. Just Joffrey. Jeff.
Just Jeff. So... Yeah, there's a scene between, as we said, Laenor and Rhaenyra where they talk about their sexual orientations and how she prefers roast duck to goose. And it took me a little bit to figure out like what exactly she's talking about, but I guess she understood quickly that Laenor, because they spent time as children together, and maybe she like understood that Laenor prefers the company of men, right?
Yeah, that's kind of alluded to in Fire and Blood. It seems to be like sort of like a poorly kept secret that Laenor has only ever surrounded himself with younger, like with like his peers who are men and not spent very much time with women. So I think it makes sense that Rhaenyra would have like picked up on this. I'm still a little bit confused about this metaphor because I'm like, is duck women? I literally Googled, I was like definition of duck. And it was like, apparently a duck is female. You're supposed to say mallard mm-hmm, if it's yeah, a male, yeah, whereas yeah. goose is gender neutral. So I was like, what are we saying here? Are
I
we saying that
pretty, I thought it was a pretty rough analogy. I have to, because she's like, I find it a bit greasy for my taste, right? That's what she said. And it's
and
like,
I was like, we've only seen you have sex with a man so far. What? I'm not sure, but my takeaway was that Rhaenyra is like, bisexual or pansexual or just sort of like still maybe figuring out how she feels about different people, but that like she definitely knows that Laenor is gay. I don't know. I think that they could have been a little bit clearer with the goose and the duck choices. Have you seen Schitt's Creek?
Schitt's Creek, is that what you said?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. I've seen the first season and a half of Schitt's Creek.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's an incredible moment where two characters, a guy and a girl, have sex, and the girl's kind of confused because she thought that the guy was gay. And then, like, the next day, she is trying to ask him about it without asking, and she says, like, I like red wine. I only like red wine. I, too, thought that you only liked red wine. And he's like, oh, I see. He's like, I do like red wine. I also like white wine, and I've sampled the occasional rosé. And then, like, he kind of ends it by saying, I care about the wine, not the label. And it was like, that was a very
First of all, I've seen that scene. I think it went, I think it was a TikTok audio, if I'm not mistaken.
Probably. Like,
it went viral, I think. I've seen it.
Yeah.
And that is a very clear.
Yeah.
Like, when you hear the analogy, you're like, oh, I get immediately what he's talking about.
Yeah.
This was not that.
No. I'm Googling mallards and ducks and is goose.
I prefer roast duck to goose, and, you know, the goose has too many feathers that get in my mouth, and, you know, it's like, what the fuck? What are you even talking about, Rhaenyra?
But
anyway, there's too much grease, and sometimes you, like, the bones get stuck in your teeth, you know, it's like, what? Okay, anyway, I'm just joking. I'm making stuff up. Rhaenyra and Laenor strike a bargain where she's basically like, look, we'll do what we have to do for the kingdom, but we basically will still have sex with whoever we want to. That's kind of what she's saying. It's like a reverse friends with benefits, whatever that means, right? That you basically have
marriage
sex with
benefits.
Other people. It's a marriage with benefits. You have sex with other people, you know, like, instead of each other. And Laenor seems pretty psyched about this. So. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on this kind of trio of sequences where these kind of characters get to have like personal interactions and lay out what their thoughts are on this current arrangement?
The last thing I just wanted to say was, I think in addition to it just being kind of cool to see another castle, I really liked the way that they set up Viserys kind of walking through Driftmark, still coughing, still probably a little seasick from being on the ocean. And you're just seeing all of this evidence of the, like, the grand adventures that Lord Corlys has had as a seafarer. Like, he's one of, I believe his lore is that he's the only known person in the world who has actually sailed to, like, every single continent on the planet. And you see very clearly that someone like Viserys could never have accomplished what Corlys did. Like, Viserys can't make it a few hours on a boat without feeling extremely sick, whereas Corlys is like this pillar of strength on the sea. And so it seems pretty good to, it was a really nice way of showing that Viserys is getting increasingly weaker while Corlys seems to only kind of be shoring up his strength and moving upwards in societal norms.
I thought it was also interesting the conversation between Corlys and Rhaenys, and like, they know that their son is gay, and he's like, maybe he'll grow out of it, and they understand that this arrangement puts the son in danger somehow.
Yeah,
and I appreciated that they they're not dumb. They grasp that, like, hey, maybe this will work out, but also, like, if he is gay, like, this could create a lot of problems. And which is very unfortunate that that's the case, but, like, it is obviously a reality in this show. So anyway, it felt like a very, like, mature conversation between people who care about each other and who care about their son. So
yeah.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break for a sponsor, and we'll be right back to talk more about what happens when everyone gets back to King's Landing. So it's time for the wedding. Kim Renfro.
Wedding.
There's a wedding going on. It's going to be 7 days of feasts concluding with a wedding. Amazing. Everyone's excited. People coming in from all around Westeros to pay their respects and acknowledge these things. But before we get to the wedding, Kim, there is this unfortunate matter to deal with of one of the worst scenes in House of the Dragon that's ever happened.
Yeah.
Which is when Alicent confronts Sir Criston Cole, because she's like, hey, I'm looking for your advice on something.
Yeah, I think
I need you to know.
she wants to hear from him, like, who entered Rhaenyra's room
that night,
right?
And actually, I am skipping forward a little bit because we should talk about the big confrontation that Ser Criston and Rhaenyra have. This is one of my favorite scenes of the episode because you could just tell, like, they're both, these are two people who, like, might care about each other, but now that they've had sex, they're thinking about their lives in radically different ways, right? Mm-hmm. And Ser Criston makes her a pitch. He's like, hey, run away with me, you know, come away with me and you'll be my wife and we'll sail the seas nameless and have no responsibilities. You know, it's going to be great. And Rhaenyra is more like, no, I'm still going to be queen and we will have sex whenever I want. That's like her, that is her pitch to him. And
I think she thinks she's being more romantic than she is. In that moment.
Okay, tell me what you mean by that.
Well, it's like, you're totally right that it seems very clear that they've basically both spent the hours after having sex thinking extremely differently about what this means or what they should now do. Rhaenyra kind of sees it as like no big deal because people have sex outside of marriage frequently within like the royal court. She just had a whole conversation with Laenor about how like it's totally fine that they're gonna have an open marriage or whatever. So like she thinks that she's like gets to have her cake and eat it too a little bit. Whereas
she gets to have her roast duck and eat it too, basically.
Yes. Her roast duck and her goose. Whenever she wants, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, it's so like Criston seems so sweet in his like proposal to her and like very earnest, but just like extremely naive. And as much as he tries to say, like, I've spent so much time around you, I know you, he really doesn't. Like, he totally misreads the fact that, yes, of course, she's been like chafing against her duties. That doesn't mean she wants to completely run away from her family and her rightful throne and her kingdom to be the wife of a sellsword in Essos for the rest of her days. And I think it ties in. Someone had a really insightful comment on our Decoding TV chat about this moment last episode where when Rhaenyra is being courted by all of these people and the violence breaks out and Criston sort of says like, don't look, princess. Like he tries to like shield her from it. And yeah. I think that that's like a misread of how fragile she is or how much he needs to truly be her sort of like white knight protector. She doesn't need that from him as much, but he seems to think like, oh, I need to like do this grand romantic gesture and like we're gonna have this whole lovely life outside of the realm. And she's just like, no, bro, I still want to be queen. Like, why wouldn't you want to be queen? Plus she knows this weight of the prophecy, which like she tries to talk to him about like, I can't leave my duty because Aegon united the Seven Kingdoms. And she's like about to say like, everyone's going to die if a Targaryen isn't on the throne. But he just walks away and doesn't get that piece of kind of critical information about why she's insistent on staying on the throne. So it's just tragic in a lot of ways, especially added with the fact that she did instigate that situation. She did put him in a lose-lose position. And now he feels like he has sullied his honor, which is very important to a lot of people in the realm. And she's not really doing anything to reassure him about that. She's just sort of, if anything, being like, no, you can keep sullying your honor. Yeah. It's fine. So
he's old school. You know, he's the type where if he has sex with someone, he's like, we got to get married so that I can like redeem this somehow. And he doesn't realize that she is really not old school. And that's a big problem and challenge for them.
But also like abandoning your post and running away with the heir to the throne wouldn't necessarily restore your honor. It like wouldn't restore his public reputation. But for him, it seems like it would resolve something internal that he's having a really hard time with, which is that he wanted to honor that white cloak and she very notably sullied it.
A couple of other assorted reactions to that scene. One is, I don't know about you, but haven't we all been part of this conversation with our a partner of ours, where it's like one person's complaining about their job and the other person says, well, you should just quit that job. And then they're like, why would I want to do that? No, that's wrong. That is a complete misread of the situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that all of us can relate to that. And so I appreciated that part of the scene. The other thing that I really liked about the scene is that at this point, we as a viewer have way more information than Sir Criston about the consequences of what would happen if Rhaenyra actually did do what she suggested. And I think we as the viewer don't think it's a good idea. You know, I think maybe when if I was a kid watching this, or if I was younger watching this show, I'd be like, yeah, they should run away together. Like, why shouldn't they be happy? But watching this as a old desiccated person such as myself, I'm like, yeah, that's a terrible idea. Like, there is no part of me that thinks that that is a good idea for her to run away, because the consequences would be immense. Like, it would create chaos in the entire kingdom. You know, people would die because of it.
Probably. Yeah, probably.
So.
No, you're right. That's why there's a naivety to what he's proposing that's very obvious to us. And to him, it's like, I'm being a true knight or something trying to.
But it's a really interesting way of kind of putting us in, like, I'm not endorsing Rhaenyra's position either, because he says, so I'm to be your whore. That's what he says, quote, you know, that's how he views it. And I'm not saying Rhaenyra's position is super strong either, but it does make us think in a big picture way about the kingdom in House of the Dragon and its consequences. And that's only true if you have like pretty good world building in the show.
Yeah.
And I like that about it. So anyway, all right, back to the kingdom. So Allison's like, what's going on with Rhaenyra? I got to figure this out. So she invites Sir Criston to talk to her. Sir Criston is already smarting from this whole encounter that she's had with Rhaenyra. And then this is the scene that I was talking about as like one of the worst scenes in House of the Dragon. On last week's episode of the podcast, I talked about how I hate that like sitcom-y trope where two people, not hate, but like I felt it was inappropriate for House of the Dragon, where two people are talking about one topic and they each think they're talking about a different thing. And then it's like, oh, wow, a comedy of errors ensues.
Yeah.
Where we have a misunderstanding. By the way, extremely similar scene to this occurs in The Crown season one about Winston Churchill's health. And so I was like, wow, it's very, I literally just watched it this week too. And my wife was listening to the podcast. She's like, I don't even understand why Dave is taking so much time to go into this, because House of the Dragon would never do something that stupid. And then literally this scene happens where she's like, I want to talk to you about Rhaenyra having sex with ... someone who shall remain nameless in this conversation. And then he's like,
me, it was me. I had sex with her.
I
thought of you. I was like,
thank you. Thank you.
Dave's going to have feelings.
Anyway, extreme silliness aside, there are a couple of other things about the scene to point out, right, Kim?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I love that Allison's back in like that blue dress. We haven't seen her in this dress since the rose ceremony that happened in episode 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, 2. Oh my God, so much has happened in so few episodes. This is impressive.
It's the dress with like the slits on the on her
those
arms,
cutouts.
Basically. Yeah.
Which I think is sort of like she's putting herself back in like, this is almost like the one last gasp to have faith in Rhaenyra again, I think, or like to try and maintain their relationship. Like if Criston can tell her like, no, Prince, like nothing happened. The moon tea thing is like a weird fluke. We don't know where it came from. I don't know. Like, so I don't know what she's hoping to hear from Criston, but I think she has some hope that maybe Rhaenyra is redeemable in her eye. And then of course she gets like the worst possible news, which is like, not only did Rhaenyra have sex outside of marriage, she did it with a Kingsguard who is sworn to chastity. And I think that this is such an important scene because both Alicent and Criston are treating each other with like a lot of sort of like royal dignity of the court, you know, like she invites him in. She says like, no, please sit down. He like, he flips his white cloak over her bench and they're both like seated very formally. It's like the complete opposite of the way that Rhaenyra was treating him, with like being playful and making him come in the room. And like Alicent is doing the thing that a royal should in this circumstance, which is like, be very dignified, not really come right out with any sort of like raunchy allegations or whatever. They both kind of talk around it. And I think that they both recognize in each other that they have the same like moral values, right? Like mm-hmm. he not only confesses, but says like, I know that I now must die basically for breaking my vows and for doing it in such a sincere way. And he kind of appeals to her mercy and says like, kill me cleanly. And then to her, the fact that he is so torn up about this is like more evidence that Rhaenyra is in the wrong here and that Kristen is like the wronged party.
Yeah. Rhaenyra has corrupted this fine young knight, unfortunately.
Right.
Speaking of Googling, I had to Google what gelding means. Didn't know that.
But oh, really?
It basically means castrating, for those who don't know.
I don't know what it says about me that I knew that. Right away.
You're Googling mallards, I'm Googling gelding, you know.
If anything,
our search histories are amiss.
I Googled, now I can't remember. He calls her a certain word that means merciful. He calls her a something queen.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. Someone.
Oh, a Clement, I believe.
Yeah.
Clement.
I didn't have to Google gelding, but I had to Google Clement, which, yeah, is like merciful or...
Kim has got all your gelding definitions covered, but when it comes to mercy, less so. All right. There is a scene with Viserys and his hand.
Mm-hmm.
We're at his room and he's in bad shape. We see the sun is setting on his Valyria model, perhaps a metaphor for the sun setting on the great old days. You wrote in the show notes, Viserys' whole arm is rotting. I think this is actually not quite clear in the show because they don't show a close-up of it. But you see a maester like applying like paste to his arm. I think it could be paste that we're seeing in the background and not his whole arm like rotting away.
Oh.
But I think it was a little ambiguous. But like from what I could tell, I was like, wow, that is there's so much paste-like stuff on his arm. I don't think that's actually his arm rotting. I think it's just...
It's like up past his elbow.
Yeah, yeah.
They
applied it all over his elbow. But I agree. Usually Game of Thrones or House of Dragon would show like a close-up of like the crab going into the wound or all this stuff. But they don't show it in this episode, right?
Remember the like grayscale pus with like a soup bowl or something
yeah. Anyways. so it's actually out of character for them to not show a close-up of what's going on, but whatever. So
yeah,
you just assume the worst case scenario. That's completely fine.
The point is it's getting worse, right?
Yeah.
That like it started with his fingers and now something is happening all the way up his arm. And the way that he asks for Alicent in this scene I think is also very reminiscent of the previous episode where like all of the attendants were there and she kind of shooed them away. And then he says like, your touch is much more gentle. And we sort of see in this scene that he's asking for her and she has begun to like withdraw herself from being his like 24/7 caretaker.
Yeah. He has a conversation with his hand, his new hand, the Otto Hightower replacement. What's the new hand's name again?
Sir Lionel Strong.
Sir Lionel Strong. And he talks about, how will I be remembered? You know, what will my reign be remembered for? Because there was no major conflicts. There's no major battles. There wasn't anything necessarily that he did super well. And so I asked you the question, Kim, hey, what do the history books say about King Viserys? Now, we do want to say before we get into this that I think you have chosen some information from the book that is not spoilery and does not indicate like potentially if King Viserys goes insane later and kills a lot of people. Like that will not be like that could still happen depending on, you know, what happens later on the show. But like we've chosen portions from the book that are fairly innocuous. So
I chose some quotes from Fire and Blood that are mentioned around this time of events happening. Right. So yes, nothing forward looking, but yeah, the historians in Fire and Blood kind of credit King Viserys's reign as, quote, the apex of Targaryen power in Westeros, unquote. And they say that he's generous, amiable, open-handed, very well loved by both like the small folk and lords alike. They called him the young king, which I think is interesting. In the books, he's like in his mid-20s, I think, when he ascends the throne and is maybe only in his like 30s. It kind of seems to me like they're sticking with like Paddy Considine's about age, right? So he's like in his 40s, I think, in House of the Dragon. But yeah, basically Fire and Blood paints him very well. And I think that it's a very intentional point that House of the Dragon is making, that those history books were very biased towards in favor of Viserys and in favor of any man for the most part. So it's it is interesting that they have him ask that question out loud in this episode when anyone who's read Fire and Blood kind of knows the answer of how George R. R. Martin's historians decided to remember him.
It's been so fascinating to hear you talk about Fire and Blood, because it seems like there's a lot of stuff that's subtext or theorized about in Fire and Blood that we now have confirmed in the show, you know, things like what happened with Daemon and Rhaenyra at the town square, and what happened with Daemon and his wife, and
also Rhaenyra and Sir Criston. That was something in Fire and Blood which we haven't even really talked about, which is that it just says that they had a falling out, or that like their relationship somehow changed, but no one really knew why. And there were like rumors that he had approached her and she turned him down, or like she approached him, or like he
found something out about her. None of their sexual relationship is in the book, then, is what you're saying?
Not as we've seen it play out in House of the Dragon, no.
Got it.
Yeah. So super interesting that we're getting this more objective perspective. I think the way that Ryan Condal, the showrunner and primary writer of this season, described it to me was like a god's eye view. Like, we get to kind of see everything that's happening behind closed doors, whereas most of the characters aren't privy to all that information at the same time.
We get to the wedding feast, and there's a lot going on in this scene, a lot of interactions, a lot of moments that are caught between the characters. And this scene also takes place in the throne room. They outfitted the throne room to be suitable for a wedding feast, which I had a couple of reactions to. I was like, this is either a really creative way of showing the throne room in a different light, or a really creative way of saving money on another location for a wedding feast. Or possibly both. Why not both? Why not both? And again, I think in the scene, we're seeing more of like what the ceiling of the throne room looks like.
Yeah.
In a way that we haven't in the past. My guess is all that's like CG, but I just thought it's worth noting, because usually in all the shots of the throne room in Game of Thrones, we only see up to a certain height. And then in like last episode and this episode, we're seeing more of like what's above. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just kind of, I'm interested in it from a filmmaking, like visual effects perspective, like how they pull something like that off. But anyway.
Yeah.
So one of the great details of the wedding feast happens in the throne room when a certain character is depicted, right, Kim?
Yeah, we finally get a look at Mushroom. Mushroom is the name of a man who is, he's basically one of the like primary sources of information that you read in Fire and Blood. So this fake history is kind of being transcribed by a maester, but he references like Mushroom's testimony very frequently. And Mushroom is a little person. He was kind of known as like the fool at court. And in the book, they kind of explain that a lot of people basically underestimated his intelligence and therefore would talk openly in front of him about things that they wouldn't want anybody else in the court to know. So the idea is that he's like this font of super secret information. But at the same time, his testimony also seems very unreliable. Mushroom loves to talk about how giant his member is and like how he was involved with sexual relations at court and all this stuff that's very salacious. But yeah, I interviewed Paddy Considine, who plays Viserys, in a preseason interview. And he told me, I said I would save this until this episode happened, but he mentioned that he had read the books, he read Fire and Blood, and he claims credit for requesting that Mushroom appear in this wedding scene. And so I thought it was cool that we finally got that flash of him.
So who is Mushroom in the show? Like, just for those who don't know, like, what is he?
Oh, yeah, Mushroom. They only show him twice. He's playing drums with the band in the background of the wedding scene. And he has sort of like long, a little bit of like salt and pepper hair. And they just show like a flash of him once on like the we get like a wide shot of the band that kind of like kicks into action. And then later in the middle of sort of like the dance frenzy, we once again see him sort of like chilling out and hitting those drums.
Gotcha. Kim, I want to let people know, if people are enjoying our scintillating dialogue, where can they find more of your work on the internet?
Great question. Because if you want to know what Mushroom looks like, go find my Insider article where mm-hmm. there's a photo of him in it. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kim R. Renfro. And then all of my entertainment writing coverage of the show is on insider.com. So Google away. I'm out there.
I also want to say, in addition to Kim's work, one resource I consider essential to understanding House of the Dragon and TV in general right now is Miles McNutt's Episodic Medium newsletter. I would highly recommend you check it out. This is one of the newsletters that I consider like this is a must read every week. Amazing TV critics on there writing awesome work. Donna Bowman and a lot of people from AV Club have joined Miles McNutt at Episodic Medium, and I'm just really enjoying it a lot. I would highly recommend you check it out at episodicmedium.substack.com. We'll leave a link in the show notes. I really love their coverage of Better Call Saul. It was just like my weekly ritual was to read the Better Call Saul stuff. Of course, I also love Miles's coverage of House of the Dragon as well, but huge fan of episodicmedium.substack.com. In between Episodic Medium and a decodingtv.com membership, all your TV watching needs, I think, are completely covered. So anyway, we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be right back. All right, let's get to the rest of the episode. I don't know that we want to talk about like every single thing that happens. You know, I think
so
maybe
much.
We should talk about like major stuff that happens. Mm-hmm. There's a confrontation between Damon and Lady Royce's cousin. We already talked about that earlier. You know, Damon coming back is a big deal because he was kind of cast out of the kingdom last week, right?
And Viserys like literally doesn't say a word.
Yeah.
Just silently nods for like a chair to be added, which again, we're seeing how like it's just a big weakness of Viserys's, right? That he can't handle a confrontation when it should happen. And him being this permissive to Daemon still is like, what do you think's going to happen, my dude? Of course he's going to go try and make out with your daughter on the dance floor. You just let him wander in here uncontested.
Yeah, it's a good lesson to learn. That if a political figure does something very terrible and they are not punished, it just emboldens them further to do bad things in the future. Not referring to anyone specifically. I'm just saying in general, mm-hmm. something you should consider.
Indeed.
Okay. We should talk about the entrances, right? The Valyrians walking in, completely badass. They look amazing, you know,
yeah.
like walking in with all their regalia and everything.
Yep.
Thought that was awesome.
Full standing ovation. It's funny to see all the families arrive, like in all of their house colors, like
yeah.
their little, like, it's almost like a big family reunion or like mm-hmm. multiple families all wearing matching t-shirts, but it's like, they've all coordinated their outfits for the welcome feast here. Freaking Lannisters, because can I just say one thing about, because you played, I love that you picked that clip for mm-hmm. the start of the episode, because the Lannisters just continue to be the worst. But again, that moment, that entrance, and like that he makes this quip about like, oh, well, this is why women couldn't possibly like win wars. And again, Viserys just doesn't refute that, nothing. Like Rhaenyra just kind of sits there being like, thanks so much for that little sprinkle of misogyny at my wedding feast. Bro.
I mean, the charitable way to read that, Kim, is Viserys is just being polite. And
that's how injustice continues, David Chen, is politeness in the face of bigotry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You got to call it out.
Now you see the violent inherent in the system. It's
white
true.
Man to white man. You got to call your own out.
Mm-hmm,
and he
mm-hmm.
doesn't. Anyways, yes, lots of good entrances, including the crappy Lannisters.
Alicent comes in. And she comes in super late. And I'm glad they added this dialogue in where it's like, whoa, the king's going to be pissed that she came in and interrupted his speech. Because I was like, I wouldn't really know why he would be pissed if they didn't say that. Because it wasn't much of a speech. I'm just going to put that out there. It wasn't like he wasn't in the middle of a stem winder or anything like that. It was just like, he had just been like, welcome to the event. And then, you know, it's like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But she comes in wearing the Hightower colors of war. Right? Is that right?
Yeah. So you'll see, I noticed it on Otto Hightower's horse. Like the sigil is a tower with a green flame at the mm-hmm. top. And so yes, that green flame symbolizes the call, basically like the call to banners for House Hightower. And it's very clear right away that she matches the rest of her family who has already arrived. I love this moment because it shows, like, obviously the color of her dress is signaling a big departure from Targaryen and all the other public facing things that we've seen Alicent doing. She's wearing House Targaryen colors. But also, her interrupting Viserys, it shows that, like, it's almost like a parallel to the scene of Rhaenyra coming back from her night where she murdered the boar, right? Where, like, you see the whole realm respond to this young woman making an entrance, and it clearly registers with a lot of people that Viserys didn't know she was going to come late and in this, like, dramatically different allegiance-bearing dress. And, yeah, I just... it's definitely it's an empowerment moment for Alicent, which she hasn't had very many of those yet in the season. She's mostly kind of been diminished every time that she's at court. But this is the first time where it's like, all eyes on you, baby. And you look great.
Indeed. And I think we spoke in our weekly Twitter space last night about how Alicent at this point is probably pretty fed up with the Targaryens. You know, mm-hmm. She's been subject to this king's whims and she's not happy about that, but the person that she trusted, Rhaenyra, in some ways betrayed her because Rhaenyra swore on her dead mother's life, last week's episode she said on her dead mother's life that she had not
that Daemon never touched her, which is definitely not true.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then she also just, like, conveniently omitted the fact that she banged her Kingsguard.
It was more of a lie of omission than commission, you know what I'm saying? But and so at this point, Alicent feels probably like she's done with the Targs. She's like, they've taken to it. And she has tried to do the right thing at every stage. She's tried to be obedient. She's tried to do the right thing for the kingdom. She's tried to be sensible and honorable. And she sees King Viserys, who obviously has his own shortcomings, but then Rhaenyra, who doesn't seem to have any honor in the way that Alicent has honor.
Yeah.
And I can understand why she'd be upset.
Yeah. And Laerys kind of makes this comment in the Godswood about her being an outsider. And it's true. And it's like there are religious differences, right? Like, Alicent and most of the realm follow the faith of the Seven. I'm pretty sure that's why there are supposed to be 7 days of the wedding celebration, by the way. That it's like, it's all tied in with what is supposed to be the ceremony around this specific religion that everybody but the Targaryens generally believe in. The Targaryens did, Aegon the Conqueror was anointed by a Septon and accepted the faith of the Seven, but there's always been, we've talked about this with the incest, right? That there's this idea that Targaryens have their own customs and sort of moral structure around the best way to run a kingdom. And clearly a lot of the other lords and ladies disagree with that. And I think that this episode shows us how Alicent is, like, really starting to put a lot of judgment on the way that the Targaryens behave. And she and Kristen Cole, I think, believe that it's entirely immoral and that it's not something that they can tolerate, basically, or it's not something that they can just go along with. They both feel very strongly that, like, there are rights and wrongs, you know, lying, deception, sinful behavior, like, all these things shouldn't just be excused. They are really trying to continue towing the line of duty.
Other confrontations that occur during this wedding feast, one of them is between Joffrey and Sir Criston, that kind of sets off the events of the rest of the episode. And Joffrey, in a little bit of a plot convenience, but Joffrey is able to observe Rhaenyra and Criston and figure out that they have a thing for each other. But it's like, okay, I don't know if that's really believable, but fine. You know, I the show did enough work to make me understand that that's what they're trying to convey. Because you basically see Rhaenyra and Criston looking at each other, and then you see it cuts to Joffrey observing that, and he's like, what's going on? So then he shares that information with Laenor, and then he shares that information with Sir Criston, which would be his final mistake.
Bad call.
And he says essentially something along the lines of, hey, you know, we both care about these people that are getting married, and we both know their secrets. And if we are able to keep their secrets, then we keep us safe as well. Now, this leads to the big question of the episode, which is what is it that causes Sir Criston to freak out at the end and attack Joffrey? And there's been a couple of different interpretations of this online. And I think that the show, in my opinion, could have done a better job of showing what the lead up to this was and like why it might have taken place in the way it did. The show chose to do it in such a way that when this big fight breaks out, it's very confusing. There's chaos. And that's very useful as a storytelling technique because you are in the same position as the characters. You're like, what's going on? But then like, as a result, I think Sir Criston wailing on this guy's face just kind of comes a little bit out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It's shocking. It's like, oh, wow, I didn't see that coming. But wait, why did that even happen? Now, over at decodingtv.com, one of our subscribers, Darnell, writes, quote, "If you rewatch the scene, it's pretty clear to me that Joffrey threatens Sir Criston. There are a lot of things going internally going on emotionally with Sir Criston, as you both pointed out. But that was the cherry on top that ultimately led to Joffrey's death. I didn't think he deserved to die. But it is nice to see that there are consequences for his actions. I hate in TV shows when one character makes a threat to another character and then just walks off. In real life, and especially back then, there would be immediate consequences for such words." Now, I've rewatched the scene, Kim. I should say, end quote. I've rewatched the scene, Kim, and I think it's very possible to interpret it as Darnell interpreted it, but like, I still don't know if that's how I would interpret it, because he basically says, look, if you keep the secret safe, you keep us all safe. And by keeping the secret safe, we're all safe. And so like you could read it as like, oh, if you don't keep the secret safe, your life is in danger. Right.
Yeah.
That's a way you could read it. But I think probably the interpretation I land on is just that Sir Criston has had so many intrusions into his sense of what is right and wrong at that point, that is just the thing that tips him over. Like he has the very unfortunate conversation with Rhaenyra. He has the conversation with Alicent where he expects to be tortured and or killed afterwards. And so he's bearing all that. And then this other guy comes in. And he's like, oh, this guy knows the secret too. Like, that's just, it's too much for him to bear, I think.
Yeah.
That like, oh, this other guy not only knows about it, but like is okay with this thing that I am not okay with.
Is okay with it, is brazenly talking about it in close proximity to like all the most powerful people in the kingdom who have been assembled into this room and is talking very casually, not only about extramarital sex, but having extramarital sex with another man, which I think would also offend Sir Criston's mm-hmm. sensibilities. Mm-hmm. When I finally saw that the piece of chaos is happening is him kind of like wailing on Joffrey, I assumed that it's like, obviously, Joffrey made a huge calculated mistake here in not only presuming that Criston is definitely the person that Rhaenyra is sleeping with, but presuming that he is okay with it to the point that he would speak openly about it. And you sort of see Criston like tense when Joffrey walks away. And then in my mind, it's like Criston just stood there stewing for another few seconds and then was like, okay, no, fuck this. Like, loose lips sink ships. I gotta shut this down because like, everything hinges on nobody knowing that I have sullied my white cloak. Like, his reputation is at stake. His life
really?
Is
so
at
you
stake.
Think, so
I don't know if we're supposed to think that there was more to that conversation. But like,
no. So I agree with that.
Yeah.
But the thing I was kind of saying about is, does he really think he still has a future in the Kingsguard? Because I don't think so, right? Like,
killing that guy?
Yeah,
killing Joffrey?
I think he's just, because you're like, my reputation's at stake. What you're implying is that by killing him, he can save his reputation.
No, you're right. Because then he goes to, he decides to die by suicide afterwards. Yeah. So I think that, yes, it was not a, it's not a well thought out thing.
Well, it seems to me it's a crime of passion, I think.
Crime of passion. Well, it's a hate crime is what I think.
Yes,
it
fair
is.
Enough. Yeah.
Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that the person that wound up taking, absorbing all the violence and punishment for this was a gay man who had the audacity to openly speak about mm-hmm. being in a relationship with another man. So, yeah, it was awful. I feel for Sir Criston a lot throughout this episode. And then this was when I was like, oh, okay, this is who you are when, like, you know, gloves come off, is you're just going to beat the crap out of a man in front of the rest of the realm in a really awful, like, it's one thing to punch a guy. It's another thing to beat his head into pulp and punch the king consort. He hits Laenor too. When Laenor kind of like tries to shove him off, Kristen totally hits. That's the reason why Laenor's like nose is bleeding throughout his entire wedding ceremony. It's because Sir Kristen punched him in the face. It's terrible.
Speaking of punches, awesome part of the episode is when Sir Harwin gets tapped in. He's like, okay, get the princess. You know, you got to do this. And the whole time I'm wondering, where is Sir Kristen in all this? Oh, he's the one that initiated the fight. Okay.
Yeah.
And then Sir Harwin just goes like literally punching people left and right. And it's like, ooh, like, again, going back to my Crown rewatch, there is a scene in The Crown season one where one of the queen's sister accidentally says some words that are slightly impolitic and needs to apologize for them to like a bunch of people, needs to like write letters of apology and stuff like that. And I kept thinking to myself, man, the King Viserys really and or Sir Harwin are really going to need to write a lot of apology letters after punching a bunch of Valyrians in the face this episode, you know?
Yeah.
There's a reason you don't send someone in there to punch a bunch of people, because you're like, these are probably like important diplomats he's punching, you know?
None of them are more important than the heir apparent to the throne, I guess, in that moment, you know?
It's so true. All right. So people flee because this guy gets killed. It's a brutal killing. And I think brought about for the reasons that we've tried to articulate on this podcast. And then I guess they decide to cancel the feast and just go straight to the wedding, right? Straight to the marriage. So there is a hastily convened marriage that occurs on, or wedding that occurs kind of in the same hall, but like in the ashes of everything that's already happened. I think it's like really well framed, and the set dressing is like appropriate, that it's like, oh, you know, this terrible situation. Also, yeah, as you mentioned, Sir Kristen tries to off himself, but Alison stops him. So as far as we know, Sir Kristen's still alive. We'll see what happens. And I think Alison stops him for the reasons that you've already discussed, which is like she sees herself as like similar to Sir Kristen. They're equally honorable, perhaps, even though he's made some mistakes.
Yeah, it's like they have both been able to independently come to the conclusion that Rhaenyra and by proxy Viserys and the Targaryens are like ruining lives and putting and being very reckless with other people's lives and honor and traditions. And I think that that is a key. She clearly needs allies in King's Landing after her father leaves. And so the episode is sort of seeing how she decides to pick up people that she thinks she can trust. And I think her going to Sir Kristen is a big moment for both of them, because he's ready to die in the Godswood, which is really dark, but she stops him.
And then the episode ends with a pool of blood and a rat coming onto screen and nibbling at it a little bit, which, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, Kim, but I think that that rat symbolizes just the lowered, disgraced state of the Targaryen household at that point, you know? What do you think? Do you think there's a little symbolism there?
I don't know. I love blood rat. Like, why not?
So I'm being sarcastic. If you can't tell, I'm being sarcastic, everyone. Because this, and here's my rant. I'm about to go off on a big rant about the subject. I think you have to stop ending movies and TV shows with shots of rats. It's too on the nose, folks. It is too on the nose. Martin Scorsese, one of the greatest filmmakers of our time. Spoilers for the Departed movie that Martin Scorsese directed. But at the end of The Departed, there is a brutal murder that occurs, and then a rat crawls onto the screen in Martin Scorsese's The Departed, symbolizing that that guy that was killed was a rat. It is too on the nose and bad, and it was so bad that someone even created a Kickstarter campaign to digitally remove the rat from that scene in the movie. Here's a clip from the Kickstarter campaign.
What's up, Kickstarter? My name is Adam Sachs, and I'm looking to raise money to digitally erase the rat from the end of the movie, The Departed. Now, The Departed is a great Scorsese gangster movie about a South Boston gang trying to find the police informant, or rat, within their ranks. But unfortunately, the movie has one giant, glaring flaw. In the last shot, Scorsese has an actual rat crawl across screen. The rat symbolizes rats. I mean, I get that this was just a studio film for Scorsese, but it is insane to me that he would end any movie with such a painfully on-the-nose metaphor. Which is why, in the tradition of Steven Spielberg and George Lucas digitally altering their movies after the fact, I want to digitally erase the rat from the end of The Departed. But unlike Lucas and Spielberg's changes, this will make The Departed a much better movie.
That was from Adam Sachs's Kickstarter campaign to digitally remove the rat from the end of The Departed. I do want to say that Warner Brothers had no chill. Similar to all the side pieces in this episode of House of the Dragon, Warner Brothers had no chill about this, and they basically forced Kickstarter to remove the campaign from their website. So Adam Sachs never actually completed his mission.
For shame.
But I'll link to the video in the show notes. It is one of the most brilliant like Kickstarter videos I've ever seen. It's hilarious. And unfortunately, the creators of House of the Dragon did not learn the lessons of Martin Scorsese's The Departed. They put a rat in at the end. It's too on the nose. It's clunky symbolism, folks. Stop putting in rats at the ends of your TV shows and films. Rant over.
I like Blood Rat. He's my friend. he's just there for the scraps. The fact that Lador had to get married within sight of his love's blood, gnarly, but fine. You can have your strong rat feelings. I see them and I validate them, David Chen.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Any other thoughts on this episode of House of the Dragon, Kim Renfro?
Besides Blood Rat? it's what I'm calling him. I hope it's been the same rat. I hope that rat is also the rat that was like watching Alicent and Viserys have terrible coercive marital sex. When else did we see a rat? Oh, the rat hanging out like in the secret passageway behind Rhaenyra's room, you know?
Yeah.
It's Blood Rat. It's not doing anything wrong.
And on that note, I think we can wrap things up for the podcast episode.
Great.
You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Find us on YouTube at youtube.com/acastofkings. Join millions of other viewers on TikTok at tiktok.com/@acastofkings. And you can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with another recap of House of the Dragon. Next week, it'll be episode 6. Very curious where this one's going to go. Until then, she is Kim Renfro. I am David Chen. Thanks so much for listening.
Goodbye.